people and bad ones too. You are listening to Feel Free to Deviate, the podcast about people, their careers, and their relationships with success. This episode features Dr. Kei Atsuki. We met when I first moved to the Netherlands so long ago. We were both students in the same Dutch class. Her title is Associate Professor in International Development Studies at Utrecht University, but she tells me that she views her role as bringing awareness and trying to find a bridge for communication between interested parties. That is to say that she is an intermediary or a socio-eco diplomat. Well, she didn't say that, but I'm saying it now. She also trains eager young minds how to do this as well. The bottom line is that she does way more than most of us to make a difference in the world, but don't let that bring you down. We're all playing our part, and sadly, there is virtually no way for any of us individually to impact the big picture. It's a good talk. You should be excited to listen. I want to share that I've already noticed that it's getting lighter every single night, and I love it. Other than that, I don't have much to report. I'd like to mention that if you have any feedback or questions about Feel Free to Deviate, you can send them to me. The email address is mail@feelfreetodeviate.com. You can also contact me via social media @feelfreetodeviate. I'm on Instagram and Facebook, though. I sometimes don't notice when I'm contacted there. If I don't get back to you quickly, please don't be offended. I'm probably looking at a headphone review or something. Oh, and I'd like to have an economist on the show. Maybe you know an economist. Let me know. I'd like to make something happen. Okay, enough of that nonsense. This is my conversation with the good Dr. Kei Atsuki.
I remember once a long time ago when I was in Ecuador or something on the top of the mountains, there was a radio station that they interviewed me.
Well, I'm sure their setup was a little bit more high-tech than this. There were probably fewer blankets involved.
It was a bit more mobile, actually, the whole thing.
Oh, for real?
Yeah, like a mobile in the sense that it can move. It's not like a setup studio.
Well, this is the super professional studio. This is where the magic happens. If Marlene knew that we were doing this in these conditions, she would be mortified.
Oh, really?
You didn't play. You left the sheets up. Like, yeah, they blocked the sound, you know. I know it looks like some kind of a low-rate laundry room, but it makes it sound a little bit better.
Professional studio. Yeah.
I always call you Kei.
Yeah.
And I know that Europeans always say Kei Atsuki.
Yeah.
But isn't it actually Atsuki Kei?
Yeah.
So what do you prefer?
No, Kei Atsuki is okay because that's what I'm known for.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it doesn't have to be the Japanese way of saying it.
That's cool. I just don't know how people feel about that.
And then Kei is good. For Dutch people, it's always Kai. They always pronounce it wrong. But then it's a Dutch pronunciation of my spelling.
Sure.
Yeah. But Kei is fine. I used to spell my name K-A-Y because we can choose whatever way we spell in English letters.
Right. No?
Because I have my Japanese name.
Yeah.
Went to high school in Canada.
Yeah.
And they started to say, are you Catherine? And it's short K. Like, because I used to spell my name K-A-Y to facilitate the pronunciation. But then I decided, no, I'm Japanese. Of Japanese origin, and I grew up in Japan, so I'm going to spell it in Japanese way. Now I never thought I would end up in the Netherlands, so now I'm like a Kai.
That's not my name.
That's not.
But that's good to hear that you never thought that you would end up here, because that's on my list of things. How did you end up in the Netherlands, and why did you choose Wageningen? Anyway, I have like a little intro, and then we'll just see what happens. Kei Atsuki.
Yes, Jeff.
It's been a long time, and I know very little about what you do, but it sounds like you are a force of good in the world. It also sounds like you know a lot of stuff that most people don't think about on a day-to-day basis, and maybe there's a reason for that. How do you introduce yourself when you're at the school and people say, oh, what do you do?
Oh, yeah, that was difficult, actually. My daughter came. That she had to explain the job of the parents, or she had to present.
Mm-hmm.
So for her father, it's very easy. You know, he makes sculpture. For mother, oh, I've seen you only doing blah, blah, blah in front of the computer, or occasionally you disappear in Africa or Brazil. What are you? No? And then I say, well, I'm a sociologist. I'm a geographer nowadays.
Nice.
I teach at university, so you can maybe say I'm a youth also for grote kinderen or something
like
that.
Youth for grote kinderen. Yeah. That means yeah. That's a teacher of small children.
Yes. For big children.
Oh, big children, sorry.
Yeah. Yeah. So at the end of the day, she just took the official title from the
website.
From the website, the Hof Docent or Associate Professor from the Utrecht University.
Yeah.
But how I identify myself is, primarily development sociologist and geographer nowadays. Shifted a bit. I was originally trained as a sociologist.
Which university is it?
Utrecht.
Okay. But you went to Wageningen.
For my study, yeah.
Yeah. I remember, I feel like you were finishing that up.
Yeah. When I was in Rotterdam, I moved to Rotterdam because I met my husband, well, boyfriend, when I was finishing up in Wageningen.
Yeah.
And he was already working in Rotterdam. So I decided to move in with him.
Okay.
So that's why I started to live in Rotterdam then.
Okay. So you studied sociology in Japan as well. Why did you decide to go to graduate school in Wageningen?
Ah, so that's a very long story. But I was studying in Japan. I was interested in sustainable development as a concept. So when I was studying, was the end of 90s, there was a book I read about development versus conservation, how to reconcile. Oh. And then I got very interested in that issue. You know, this is very important, but not many people are studying in Japan at that time, primarily about rainforest. You know, in Japan, there are lots of sort of development of, for example, countryside or small cities in combination with forest conservation. And there were lots of very Japanese philosophy behind it, but then it's not really linked to the global issues. So I wanted to do something out of Japan, but then explore the possibilities of sustainable development. So that was a motivation to study the social aspects of how people engage with their environment and the management and conservation while they try to develop themselves. So what happened was there was a kind of small advertisement in the university where I went in Tokyo looking for a research assistant to go to Japanese agriculture in the Brazilian Amazon. You know, it was a research topic. They were looking for like a student assistant who could go to the Amazon, interview Japanese immigrants who were practicing kind of Japanese way of farming, like a combination of different crops, and then they kind of calculate how much money they can make from the rotational agriculture without deforesting everything and, you know, put cattle or something. I applied for the position because it sounded very interesting. And then,
And also you get to go to Brazil.
Yay, the Amazon. Very curious.
It's so, totally. I've never been there.
So I went and then I liked it. It was so different from everything I knew. It's a bit
Imagine.
Like, yeah, I mean, I grew up in a place where, you know, Japan is an island. So there's no frontier, like Lego cities, no? Like people go somewhere and then just build their cities kind of situation.
Sure,
you
sure,
don't
sure.
see it. It's all very organized. So I just got very attracted to Brazil. So I stayed, actually, after the student assistantship. I just stayed. In Brazil, they have an expression, fica ficando, like a staying. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, you don't plan things that much, but then you just stayed. I did an internship, which I had to get some income. So then I did the little student jobs in Brazilian university. I looked for some opportunities there. And then I stayed. So I worked for a Brazilian NGO, actually, at that time for 2 years. What happened was that I also started to get interested in how things work, trying to work with the farmers and the forests while trying to get money out of the situation also.
From the government or from
the government, from the World Bank, all these donors.
Yeah.
So there was a big politics behind the sustainable development agenda that I started to notice while working for the NGO. And what happened was that I wanted to study about it. So I read another book about how to study development.
How to Study Development.
Development.
I didn't know that book existed.
So the whole problem about, for example, deforestation in the world is that people want to develop, right? That like people want to develop economy, develop society, the cities that don't become compatible with keeping the forest. So then it always becomes the problem. If I try to do something about it, then you have to kind of get the money to do projects. And then that's also a bit of the whole industry of development started to emerge in your... Mm-hmm. So it's not only ideal, but you have to learn how the politics of development actually works in relation to conservation. So some people study politics of conservation also. And then I got interested in studying about it a little bit. And the book, it's called Battlefields of Knowledge. It's about the development projects, whether you try to conserve the forests by giving jobs to smallholders who used to slash and burn.
Yeah, yeah.
There, you encounter lots of different, actually, fights between experts and farmers and, you know, the people try to actually negotiate. That process is the development. So not you have to be richer or you don't want to be richer, but then it's more like the negotiations that bring a development, and then that's how we have to actually understand. And I thought it was pretty cool way of looking at the
That never even occurred to me.
No, the world of, how the world should progress or how the world should develop. So then I looked up who were doing those research, and they were in Wageningen University.
Okay, right on. Of course they were.
And they had a sociology department. Now they changed the name, but then at that time it's called Rural Development Sociology Group of Wageningen. Well, Wageningen University actually is known for more agricultural sciences.
Okay.
So social sciences department is not that super big. So there were a kind of small group of researchers focusing on those development as a field. Mm-hmm. So development projects, you can kind of really study about who are involved, what kind of knowledge is generated, what kind of contestations happen. And I wanted to be a part of that group. I thought it was kind of interesting way of understanding how we think things should be. And then that's not actually the way that we should actually implement our ideal, because that's not going to work at the end of the day. So that is why I came to Wageningen in the first place. And then I wrote the PhD thesis there, the dissertation about forest conservation ideal in the Amazon and how people themselves who live there and actually deforest have their own logic of doing it, and how actually Western forest conservation idea is going to be backlashed because we are not understanding very well how people are actually dealing with the situation. So my message was that we should actually try to really engage with those destroyers of the forest, that we don't like them, but then...
They're part of the equation, so
exactly.
You need to engage them.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
So that was the kind of first work I did. And afterwards, I went back to Japan for a while to do the similar things, how to really understand the people who have a different ideas about development, let's say.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Is that when Marlene and I visited?
Yeah.
Okay.
In Tokyo, yeah.
Still before kids.
So at that time, I was moving around a lot also. There was more liberty.
When you went to Wageningen, and that's when you met Dawa.
Mm-hmm.
Your Dutch man friend.
That was unplanned. So that was the problem.
Yeah. That's usually how it is. It's not on the checklist.
Exactly.
Meet Dutch person and spend the rest of your life with them.
Yeah, indeed, actually, because I finished my study. So from Brazil, I came to Wageningen. And then I was actually intending to go back to Brazil.
Uh-huh.
Because I at that time, my head was really that, you know, Brazil is my base.
Yeah.
I didn't think about going back to Japan, but then, you know, I like Brazil, so I'm just going back with this degree. I even actually applied for some jobs in Brazil in universities.
Yeah.
Because some people invited me to apply when you get the PhD, you can apply for, you know, like a professor positions.
Mm-hmm.
That was a bit of an accident that I met Dawa. He already left and worked in Rotterdam. but I lived in his mother's house.
I was
renting a room. That's how I met him, because he visited his mother sometimes, and then we chatted. Yeah,
well, it's good that he visits his mom. I don't visit my mom.
So I knew the future mother-in-law earlier. Yeah. That helps.
That's definitely nice. Lady. You know what you're getting into. Yeah,
yeah. Brazil became a bit not an option then immediately, because he had his life being built up in Rotterdam as an artist. I mean, it's not that super easy also. But then I also immediately couldn't stay in the Netherlands because I didn't find a good job that would give me a work permit.
Right,
so then,
right.
You know, that becomes a little bit bureaucratic.
Oh, I know.
Situation where I thought of staying in the Netherlands, but then I couldn't immediately get the job. My Dutch partner's income was too low to sponsor me. So then I couldn't get the family reunion either. So that's how I decided to just go back to Japan and see if any job opportunity will come up. While I didn't want to be out of, you know, job. So then
you got to do something.
Yeah, so then I got invited to apply for a position as a research associate in Tokyo. Okay, then I would just apply there. I stayed for 3 years, I think.
Oh, okay, was it that long?
Yeah.
Goes by fast though, right?
Yeah, because actually I realized how difficult it was to find a job when you are out of the country, né? I mean, I kept on looking in the Netherlands. But like you say, you know, you need a connection or
it helps. It certainly helps.
Yeah. Or kind of to the interaction. So.
But with academia, like, you must have had some sort of connection.
Yeah. So I had still colleagues in Wageningen. I knew people who went to different universities. But at the end of the day, I found it not so easy. But at the same time, you also want to build up something in Japan just for convenience. But then I thought, okay, maybe I will do a project. So at that time, the United Nations University was not so keen on developing some research agenda in Brazil, but then they wanted to do a lot of things in Africa. That was the time when the whole international development industry was gearing towards Africa, partly because Africa was the kind of considered to be the last frontier of development, no?
Yeah.
The Latin America.
Big investment opportunities
exactly.
in Africa.
No, but it's true.
Of course it's true.
And all this big United Nations, everybody, and Japanese government was also China. I mean, you know, everyone was kind of going.
That was the big thing that I heard, that half the investors in Africa are giant Chinese interests.
Chinese interests. And the whole discourse was, Latin American and Asian countries are relatively okay, and also a lot of exploitation already had happened.
Sure. Let's start clean.
Well, let's see. And even Brazil actually started to go heavily in Africa, that they started to invest in mining industries in Portuguese-speaking countries of Africa, like Mozambique and Angola. There was a kind of very new dynamics that also led me to Africa as a researcher about development and conservation. So the last decade, I was pretty much in African context to do the similar things.
Like studying stuff, or are you actually going there?
Both.
Both.
Yeah, because, maybe I should explain how my study works, but then development studies or sociology is not so theoretical per se. It's more applied. The biggest attraction for me is, you have to have this very empirical understanding of what people do.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, the logic that I want to understand why people do the way they do when everything else says that they shouldn't. For example, farmers using contaminated water or
that
kind of thing. I mean, they have to do it maybe out of necessity.
I think that's the only explanation. Like, why would you use contaminated water unless you had to?
Yeah. But then, you know, if you start following the change of how that happens from the ground up, then it becomes more real for me than sort of reading documents and, you know, kind of only talking to the half of those who said, "Whoa, we didn't do anything wrong,"
kind of
situations. So there are lots of instances that you have to actually go there and talk to people who are not represented in the dominant discourses. That's why, yeah, you have to go. So then I started to also go to Mozambique quite a lot, in Ghana, Kenya, all these countries that started to really become a hub of new investments and development projects. That's actually how I encountered the job advert from Utrecht University about Mozambique. They were looking for somebody who could speak Portuguese. Because I could, because I did study
in Brazil for a long time.
So I can speak Portuguese. And they wanted somebody part-time.
Yeah.
And I just had a baby then. So then I didn't want to work fully.
Sure.
But then part-time will be great.
Part-time is nice.
2 days a week or something. Or even it was not 2 days a week. At the end of the day, when they asked me if I could go to Mozambique, and then they say, well, you don't have to work almost anything in the Netherlands. Just please take like 2 weeks and then go to Mozambique
and
do the field work. And I say, yeah, that's fine. As long as, you know, my partner says it's okay.
Yeah.
So that's how I got a job in Utrecht. That was also a little bit connected to my situation then.
That's so you're still going and doing field work from time to time.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, at least after the end of 2019, I cannot go anymore because of Corona.
That's a bummer.
Yes. But then before Corona, it was getting almost too much that I was complaining a lot that I shouldn't go.
Like multiple times per year.
Five times per year. And each time like 10 days or 2 weeks. So then it was getting a bit too much.
That is kind of a lot.
And with a small kid. So I had to rethink how to work.
Now you don't even have to think about it. You just can't do it.
Exactly. So Corona was actually a little bit of blessing actually for our relationship.
Let's not say that.
Yeah, because it was getting if I was forced not to travel, then I just had to endure. But I also started to find a new way of working. Because then I started to kind of pay people in that country.
So you pay them?
Yeah. So I started to think like, okay, if I cannot go, I just have to have my extension in places where I want to do my research, right?
Okay.
So then those who don't have to travel. So I started to kind of employ people, let's say in Mozambique or in Brazil. Then they do research with me. So I do it remotely.
Yeah.
And then they do it for their master thesis or PhD thesis, like a student. And then I'm like, yeah, now I understand. I actually understand how things can work without traveling. Because at the end of the day, maybe not even Corona, but because of all this don't fly so often campaign for sustainability. Sure.
That's your field, the sustainability.
Yeah.
Anyway, so that's one of my questions, how do you reconcile these sorts of things? Looking at sustainability on different levels, I'm wondering, to have all this knowledge, is it just incredibly frustrating? Most people just read an article with a headline that says, this is bad, we're running out of this resource, or this country is being exploited for its minerals, or this is happening, or this country doesn't have the infrastructure for X, Y, or Z. And you are actually on the ground in some of these places, learning the stuff, digging deep into the source, not just the headlines. So you have actual knowledge and maybe even theories on how to make the situation better. This is a long and sprawling kind of question. Do you notice improvements? Do you notice things getting better? Do you think that things are becoming more sustainable? And let's just start with that. Like, do you notice changes?
Maybe yes and no. Because some places, the people are becoming more conscious themselves, no? And also we, like researchers or project managers, I don't know, like all these professionals learn how to engage or how to talk to people in the environment that are in question. Actually, if you are in the Netherlands, I mean, so much environmental consciousness has risen in the past years, then you will notice that you know, the things are changing. Maybe in the, let's say, kind of more sustainable direction. But the problem is there are lots of instances that the very sort of quest for sustainable development or environmental consciousness also, you know, kind of stabilizes the status quo.
Yeah.
Sort of, it does, it builds on the inequality, it builds on the kind of normative image of sustainability that I started to doubt in the Amazon in the first place, that
right.
you can't tell people to conserve forests when they have totally different
exactly.
logic.
That's what it sounds.
Yeah. For example, the Brazil once went through so-called social environmentalism, that they really talked about how to reconcile the people's livelihoods or how people make living with the environmental sustainability in such a way that the people are also...
They can integrate it into
yeah,
their lives.
Yeah. Or their logic is sort of incrementally, maybe if you are really used to chopping down all the forests and then put the cattle, then it takes time for these people to change.
To stop chopping down the forest.
Yeah, but then there has to be some kind of alternatives that are equally profitable and attractive.
Sure.
So we have to come up with also together what will work.
Mm-hmm.
So that is the kind of process we were thinking, but then it just takes so much engagement. Perhaps it frustrates people in all sides. I don't know. So, you know, some like a president like Bolsonaro, like, you know, the Trump of the tropics.
The Trump of the tropics.
Yeah, he got elected and he just abolished all these efforts that in the previous years.
Then right, because it's too much effort.
He encouraged all the cattle ranchers to just develop the area.
Right.
That's the best way to do it.
Sure.
And then, shut up all the foreigners. It's our territory.
But I mean, in a way, he's right, though, that like, what do the outsiders know, except for people like you who are actually going in there and doing research?
Exactly.
And there are a lot of armchair ecologists.
Exactly. Many of the constituents within the Amazon region voted for him, which means that, you know, he's got the political support.
Yeah.
And it is hard then, without understanding that kind of political dynamics, to say something about, you know, how to conserve the forest, why everyone got so shocked about the, you know, Amazon burning and, you know, the worst deforestation rate in, like, last year was the worst.
I mean, I guess that makes sense. Every year would be the worst, right?
No, when the leftist was there, that they also was not the angel, but then they did try.
They were making efforts.
Yeah, former government was a little bit better. So then the deforestation rate stabilized quite a bit.
Okay.
So that is why it's so scandalous that, you know,
now it's skyrocketing.
Yeah, that's my point, in a sense that if you start trying to push too much of one way of, you know, forest is important, so you have to conserve it, then there will be a backlash like what we are seeing now in Brazil. And then we just have to be prepared for that, or we have to be actually wise to think about what's the best way to engage with people who don't have the same ideas.
Yeah.
And then it's the same with, in a way, in the Netherlands now, everything is like a renewable energy. We have to switch to electric cars. But then there are lots of ramifications of that, not within the Netherlands, but then also in
everywhere
globally. So I think one of the new projects I have is about conflicts that happen around the minerals and natural gas productions that are expanding in Mozambique. The things are all exported here. You know, that the minerals that you need for lithium batteries.
For batteries, yeah, of course.
Or natural gas that is...
It's pretty valuable these days.
Yeah. But then, you know, these people in Mozambique, for example, are never going to have electric cars or never going to have those lives.
Certainly not in the short term.
No. And then they are going to have all this kind of pollutions, displacement.
Yeah,
those are kind of known, but then we don't know exactly how to deal with it. And my feeling is, overall, maybe, we are talking about how to save the planet. But then, you know, we have to, or my role at this moment, I seriously think that how to think about not to sacrifice anybody or any parts of the world to have this general global sustainability. No, because that's the whole problem, that the one idea is going to be like, okay, we have to have a sustainable planet or sustainable development, while those small issues about people suffering because of that, but then in
very
far away places, we don't want to know about it.
I don't even think that it's that we don't want to know about it. You can hear about it and read about it and think it's horrible, which I do, but it's also, I'm greedy and I want to be comfortable. And whether you're in my situation or a lithium miner in Mozambique, you are greedy and you want to be comfortable, and you can fault someone for that, but mm-hmm. it's just the way it is. It's just the way it is. And you know, you want to make the best of whatever your situation is. If you don't truly understand the conditions of being a miner, you can't truly empathize with the miners of Mozambique.
Yeah.
You know, you can be what they call a bleeding heart or whatever, yeah. but you can never really understand yeah. until you understand the true horrors of what it's like to be there. And so then you're in the position where you say, okay, well, I'm going to do everything that I can to make every single industry better. I'm going to stop eating meat. I'm going to stop consuming dairy because cows are bad. I'm going to stop using lithium batteries because lithium batteries are bad. But are they bad or are they good? Because they're also decreasing air pollution in my city, which is true. Maybe not so much in Rotterdam because we have the harbor. And it's hard to wrap your head around it.
Yeah.
And it's hard to, a friend of mine was telling me recently that, you know, he's a flexitarian. He's trying to eat a minimal amount of meat, and that's great. I mean, I think that that's great for health and for your wallet and for lots of different reasons. And he was saying that the awareness of vegetarianism is higher now than it ever has been. But how does that really impact the meat industry? It's not like meat production is going down because people are more aware.
Mm-hmm. But then that's exactly why I think it's good not to be also, how do you say, kind of blindly justice warriors or sustainability warriors, you know, because then, so that's what I'm trying to say, that not to sacrifice anybody, meaning every change or transformation has to be incremental in a sense that we have to have an alternatives. Uh-huh. So let's say, okay, let's stop eating meat. There are lots of farmers who have been sustainably producing
meat. It's part of the chain.
Yeah. And then you can't, for example, well, in my view, just because, okay, well, all of the sudden cows are bad, then you start, you know, campaigning against ever. I mean, there is a very sort of, mechanical meat industry that I don't agree with.
Of course, it's gross.
But then in Japan or in many countries that the cattle have been very important, for example, culturally also, there are farmers who have been building their, not only about money and profits, then the whole life around it, then we have to understand those people. Or if they have to change, you know, we have to also understand how these people want to change in negotiation with all those other demands. So I think everything is a bit like that. Miners also, like, you know, I'm not saying that we should stop mining because then the miners would lose jobs. But then what we want to know is that what kind of changes these people want so that the whole industry can actually think about how to adjust or give alternatives, because there are lots of instances.
But it's not just the people, right? It's like the industry itself needs to adjust.
Yeah,
like instead of just thinking, I drill oil, I mine lithium or whatever.
No, they do like that at the moment.
Yeah.
So the whole logic is that, okay, you know, now we have a big reserve in offshore in Tanzania or Mozambique. So then we go and then we start drilling. And then there are lots of sort of ramifications that they started to create a huge protest or even insurgency now in the whole region because the people are pretty angry at how they know the profits are being made and shipped out of the country while, you know, they just are labor and they work, but then they don't get much of the benefits. Mm-hmm. So then the people are becoming more and more aware that, you know, something is not quite right. We are not in the colonial times that, you know, the white people come and exploit everything and go away and that's normal. It's not normal, which is a progress in itself because people notice that it's not right. So you just have to think about also then, in a way, it's a very simple question, how to make everybody happy.
Very simple question. Very simple.
Yes. Very. So that's what I'm kind of trying to do. Look into what's happening. Mm-hmm. So then a frontier between those, okay, let's dig the mineral that is needing for the sustainable development of the world while the people's livelihoods are being compromised. So then we have to actually find a way that these people also can benefit or should benefit in the way that is not being done at this moment.
Right. Are there more benefits to that level of society?
So the protests are happening, which is good, I think. Okay. You know, so for the industry, it's very bad.
They could stand to lose a little bit.
Conflict. It's a conflict. But I don't think conflicts are bad, to be extremely honest, because that shows that, you know, people have their own agency and
that's how change happens,
right? Yeah, to me, that's positive. Actual changes, yeah, the regulations a little bit, you know, for example, obliging industry to just go and start digging, but then, you know, inform consent and, you know, involve those who will be affected mm-hmm. from the beginning, from the planning. And, you know, there are lots of kind of rulings about it, and then there are lots of talks about it. So that's not a bad thing that people talk about it. Now, the real change, I think it's difficult to really say, you know, what is a good example, or I am also not that fan of talking about best practices because people start kind of window dressing everything.
People like the best.
Yeah, of course. And then, I don't know, I find it also a bit too simple. That's the kind of my kind of science. Then the development sociology or development studies is that we try to find the optimal solution in that real empirical context. So not idealistically bringing in something or labeling conflicts as problems, but then more like, you know, how people are actually manifesting their wishes so that we kind of try to understand and then bring into the industry or the government who doesn't really want to listen. I find myself increasingly a bit playing an intermediary role, perhaps.
And is that frustrating, or do you feel like you're getting somewhere?
I find it exciting, actually, because before I didn't really consciously think about, you know, bridging the gaps.
Yeah.
But then now I feel that is something that perhaps we can do, because to explain it in different way, like you say the armchair academics.
I think I say armchair ecologist.
Ecologist.
But whatever, academic too.
Yeah, I mean, that's the image people have also. And then many, actually, I can't say who, but then, you know, it's a bit, there are lots of colleagues who stop going to the field as they become big professors.
They're comfortable. That's the thing to do,
going to the... But
that's what everybody does. That's what I mean. It's like, it's easy to be comfortable.
Yeah.
And it's easy to think about your own needs or wants or desires.
Yeah. Then that's, I really... find it not right in a sense that you lose touch, I think.
Yeah.
And then that's something that I really want to avoid in my work. I mean, being in the field is very important. And try to bridge, try to talk the language that both sides or multiple sides understand.
Mm-hmm.
And then kind of try to find a solution to the problem. For example, if deforestation is the problem, you can't denounce one party.
Right. It's like one problem at a time.
Yeah.
Also, instead of like, I'm going to solve the issue.
No.
The entire country. Yeah. You have to solve specific problems.
Yeah. Because everything has a context.
Yeah.
And have people, different kinds of people involved with different cultural backgrounds or beliefs, or, you know, sometimes things are very religious also, and then you can't, you know, rationally solve it, but then still you have to talk or try to at least understand what kind of thinking behind. Because like all these Amazonian farmers who deforest, they say it's a very Calvinist way of thinking that, you know, you have to work the land.
Yeah. Protestant work ethic.
Exactly. Yeah. If they don't give them any money, it doesn't lead to any accumulation. So they have to chop it down. And then the land property gives value. The cattle you put has a value. So then...
How can you argue with value?
Yeah. And then they are very religious people.
I don't know that this really matters. You were talking about Calvinism, and then I said Protestant work ethic, but aren't Brazilians predominantly Catholic?
Not anymore.
No?
Well, predominantly, yes, perhaps still. I don't know, statistically speaking, but Brazil is the biggest evangelical country in the Western Hemisphere now.
Oh, I didn't realize that.
The big...
They're a huge country.
Yeah, like a... For example, Assembly of God or Universal Church of God, they are all Brazilian denominations that are exported to African countries.
Sure. It's like a, you got to increase the membership.
It's kind of very big export products at the moment, I think. Yeah, but for example, Bolsonaro and all these sort of authoritarian presidents also come from the very religious base. It's a bit like how Trump's, you know, the supporters are also white, very religious.
A lot of the supporters are, which I don't understand why they follow him, because I don't, I mean, that guy doesn't believe in anything. You're going to tell me that he believes in God? There's no way.
He does.
I don't think he does. I think he believes in, he knows that those people tend to like him. So he's like, yeah, they're cool. That's cool. I'll say whatever I have to say to get those people to follow, to keep liking me.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I don't want to talk about him.
No. No, but I mean, what I'm trying to say is that we can't underestimate the power of the religious doctrines behind what people do.
It is historically a pretty major thing in the world.
Yeah, but then I'm kind of surprised at how people forget, you know, when we talk about forest conservation or like how people build their lives in relation to big investments or big development projects, that we forget about the influence of how people have strong beliefs in something the way they do.
Yeah.
So that's why we have to understand it. But then, you know, it's when we, for example, talk about those issues, then it becomes government, maybe NGOs, private companies, universities. But then we don't talk about churches, or we don't talk about other, you know?
I don't think about churches pretty much ever.
But I started to also recognize in many places, like, people don't say it in a very logical ways, but then the way they do things are kind of backed by religious or church as an institution almost, you know, that where they get political messages or where they get information about how, they can get a job or how they can get money. It all comes from Sundays. Everyone goes to church and the pastor is
It's part of the community. It's
and sometimes pastor is from the political party. You see, then there are lots of connections that I think we cannot underestimate. So those are the things that, so when I go to the field, I always go to church with my collaborators from the village.
I guess that makes sense.
Yeah, to understand how I was actually pretty surprised that all the political messages are actually blasted in church service at the end of the services.
And by the way, vote for your pastor.
No, seriously. So I was a bit like, okay, this is how it works. You never know.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's why I like also to go to the field.
It's cool that you are actually hands-on about it and you have some perspective. Yeah, I guess the main thing I was wondering is it just unbearably frustrating to know what you know and study what you study and then look at the way everything is? But it sounds like you deal with it pretty well. You know, you put things into perspective.
Yeah, because at the end of the day, everyone, no? Yeah, even if you don't agree that people are wanting some kind of change, everyone is kind of dreaming of his or her own utopia, right? Like and having a, you know, I want this kind of job, I want this kind of life, a house, a car. In a way, I think it's nice that we try to, or I at least try to understand those visions of everybody and see, you know, where we can find some kind of common ground. Then I think it helps a bit in every context. Being academic is practically about being very argumentative. You know, we just have to discuss. So we are all in the community of, you know, we all agree to disagree. I think it's a very healthy environment where we just debate that, okay, this is what I've seen. This is what I think. What do you think? And then the other person says, no, this is what I know from another context. And then I don't agree with you. But that point is interesting. So we can find a way to suggest how to, for example, improve development project. Or we can't change the world, but then we can actually keep on trying to change the world. And then that's not a bad thing, I think. You see what I mean?
I do. It's not a bad thing. It's better than the nothing that
exactly.
I do.
Exactly. No, I mean, it's better than nothing. Yeah, that's maybe we are just...
At the very least, it's better than nothing.
Yeah, we just have to be modest. At the same time, yeah, we just keep on saying that, yeah, something is not quite right. So then we... I mean, if we think something is not quite right, something is not quite right.
Yeah.
Right? I read somewhere, I think it was by Lauren Berlant. She wrote something like, justice is a lack that nobody feels frustration or something like that, you know?
Wow.
And I think it's cool to think like that. If somebody is frustrated or feeling very unhappy, something is not right. So we just have to think about why not.
Yeah.
Why this happened. So sometimes just listening to one person's story can reveal really a lot of things of the country or of the situation in the world. So sometimes I actually do that. Just talk to one, you know, old woman in a village and then try to find out why things are not quite okay according to her.
Yeah. Well, yeah. What's her big source of frustration
then,
on a day-to-day basis?
Yeah, and then that reveals a lot of things. So also, I'm actually trying to understand how industry works nowadays. You know, the logic of big company or big, what happens in a boardroom kind of situation. Because we are not very good at it. We are very good at going to farmers or, you know, communities or because that's what you feel sympathized with. But nowadays, I'm kind of feeling that it is important. But then, you know, with this knowledge, maybe I should try to understand how to really talk to the powerful.
It's going to be a tough one, I think. But then, it's a whole different level of humanity.
Yes.
Have you heard any of this stuff about a lot of, again, this is me being armchair guy, a lot of high-end business people, they say have the same characteristics as serial killers, like to be, you know, I don't want to condemn all of the business people of the world, but to be a high achieving member of one of these boards, you sort of have to be able to just not feel.
Right.
And
I see that.
That's one of the characteristics that a lot of these CEOs have. It's, the guy, he's on, I don't know, I've heard interviews with him a lot on podcasts and stuff. I think he wrote a book called The Psychopath Test or about the psychopath test, and it's about stuff like that.
Oh, wow.
And
interesting.
I didn't read the book. I heard him pitching the book a million times in different places. Huh. I'm going to read the book.
Yeah.
How do you feel about the term success? Do you feel like a successful person? You know, you are fighting the fight. You're actually doing something. To me, that is successful. Whether you're actually changing in an industry, you're actually making efforts, which is about 1,000 times more than most people in the world. But also me, your approach seems to be genuine and balanced. And things are in perspective.
Yeah, but the bottom line is, I think I'm successful in the sense that I'm doing what I'm curious about.
Or yeah.
I think I want to continue looking into those kind of dilemmas of what we face, no? We want to make the world a sustainable place, but then have to address the side effects or things that could happen with that.
Mm-hmm.
Or I've seen it, that happens. So I want to keep on thinking about or writing about or talking about how to think about this sort of sacrifice-free, sustainable world.
Mm-hmm.
And I teach that also with students at the, you know, to younger generation. I don't feel I'm old, but then, now if I see...
Well, they're very young, so...
They are very young. So I have to also start talking to those big children to kind of... For them to become more sensitive also, those issues.
Yeah.
Because sometimes they come with a very genuine idea that, I'm going to stop. I'm vegetarian, vegan. Mm-hmm. I'm doing very good for the world.
Yeah.
Yeah, and to me, it's already a bit too one-sided,
you
know? It's like, have you thought about farmers who've been, you know, thinking about their own way of sustaining the world by producing good meat? But then you can't deny one thing like that. And then we start talking about those issues, or I personally hate all these big windmills, I think it is a kind of pollution to the landscape. But then, you know, okay, the Netherlands is pushing so much for the renewables.
Yeah, no, for real. And, I actually like the windmills, though, I have to say. But
the traditional ones I like, but the, those industrial ones you like?
Yeah, I like seeing the fields of them. I think that it looks cool. I like the concept. That said, I think that if I lived very close to a wind farm, I would not be happy.
Yeah, so I got a lot of students to do research in the neighborhoods of those windmills and solar farms and, you know, how they think about the...
Yeah, it's great as long as you don't live there.
Yeah, because now that, you know, my students cannot travel very easily, so then... You know, we started to do field work in the Netherlands, and I'm starting to find also very interesting all those issues. So what I want to say is, yeah, my daily life is practically that I want to think about it for myself, but then also for educating, you know, younger people to go out the field and, you know, get in your neighborhood, you know, something is happening. Then
that's key, though, right? Yeah. You have to create the next group.
Yeah. So in that sense, I have an infrastructure to do it. I'm embedded in a university. I mean, yeah, you can complain, whatever, but in general,
you can always complain.
But in general, the university is a good environment for me to do this, this. And I have good position there, which means I can do what I want to do.
I can see how that would be the case. Do you see the fruits of your labors? Are your students actually going out and doing similar field work? Is this the kind of thing that people who, when they go in to study it, are they just going because they have to go to college? Like I went to college, I just went because I had to go. Like it was just expected, and I went because that's what people did. Are these people actually integrating the systems and the concepts into their lives? And are they going and doing field work, or are they working in some other capacity to spread the word, as it were?
Even if one out of 100 students does that, I think I find it already very success. So if it's, I mean, it's impossible to sensitize all of them, but then always there is one or two who get very excited about the research or the lectures I give, or always every year I have one or two students who want to keep on informing me what they are doing and chat about their job or whatever. I find that always very good.
Is cool.
Yeah. So I'm not that ambitious in that sense. I'm not saying that I can change everybody's mind, but then if one or two persons get excited, then I think it's good.
I think it's good too.
Master students always have to do their thesis research anyway. So then they, you know, they have more chances of getting sensitized in the process.
Sure.
Because they do need to do a field work in their curriculum. Then there are more chances that they think about it at least. I teach students in Utrecht. We try to pair them with the students from those countries.
Okay.
So that they can actually work together. So curriculum-wise, I cannot really influence, but then we try to, you know, establish exchange more often, or, you know, doing fieldwork together.
Yeah.
So that our students can also learn from what the students in that country do. So in that sense, I think we can influence. And at the European level, there are kind of scholarship programs for, you know, students from those countries to come to the Netherlands. And
That's pretty cool, right?
So every year we apply, actually, it's been for Ghana and Indonesia that we've been receiving some students. Yeah, so I want to continue with that. I have a new project starting in Indonesia. Those are also kind of coupled with education programs that our Indonesian partners have their own universities and mobilize the students to do research with us. So that also a kind of new, let's say, an innovation that we want to propose. But then it's always a lot of work, actually, those things, you know, the kind of institutionally. But yeah, well, idea is to involve students in the kind of both ends.
Sure, but that's what you were talking about, the exchange of ideas. Yeah, get their perspective and you have your perspective. It's refreshing for them to hear someone looking from the outside. Yeah. And it's refreshing for you to hear someone who's actually on the inside.
Yeah.
That's a win-win.
It's a bit also we really have to avoid, or I want to avoid the situation where, you know, only rich European or Japanese, in my case, researcher comes to poor countries and, you know, like do research and then go back to a comfortable situation where to write about suffering of others.
Yes.
I mean, that's the reality.
It is the reality.
But we want at least make it conscious that we know it.
Yeah.
We know the privilege we're in.
Yeah.
And talk about it with the people there, so then they can also do what they want to do in, within their context. And we try to, for example, that kind of scholarship that we try to get to the students there, then at least they can also do the reverse. They can come, you know, they do their research in the Netherlands. You know, it can be also fun for them. Yeah,
well, yeah, of course. Yeah, that's great. I mean, that's, for me, at least when I was a student, that was the best thing. I came here.
Yeah. And so it's a bit like that we try to facilitate.
How's life? Are you feeling good about things? Are you going stir crazy with COVID?
For me, the most fun part of my job is to go to the field, and this part is being severed. So this is tough. So I'm hoping that the whole world becomes a little bit easier to visit each other.
I hope so too.
I mean, yeah, we've mastered a lot of this online life, I think, in the 2 years, but
went fast.
I'm just not super happy about it.
I don't like it either.
But, you know, because everyone tries to be positive about it. Well, now we can have a lecture from, you know, somebody somewhere else, or we can be anywhere actually online. But it's different.
It is different.
It's just very different.
I think it's fatiguing. It's tiresome.
Yeah. Yeah. But the other thing is, I don't know. Always I considered, for example, Netherlands as just a base where I work, but not paying much attention to my surroundings or what's happening. Out of necessity, I started to really observe what's happening in the Netherlands or Germany or around here.
Yeah.
As I said, you know, that I send students to do some field work around here. It's okay. You know, we can observe perhaps about the same thing or another different things, but equally interesting things around here also. So in that sense, I'm discovering a new possibilities or new ways of thinking about development, that, you know, development is not only in those developing countries.
We're all developing. I'm developing right now.
Exactly. In everywhere in a different ways, and everywhere is also connected. So I find that also interesting to keep on thinking about.
Yeah.
In that sense, yes, I'm not too happy, but then at the same time, I'm not too depressed or something.
You know, what you just said reminded me of a couple, I can't remember if it was before COVID or during COVID. It was like a day or a week. Farmers went on strike.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You should send your students to go work with them to see what the deal is, because this can be resolved with communication. We have the technology.
Yeah. That's also exactly the same kind of problems, right?
It's
nitrogen.
It's just on a different scale.
Yeah. But it's also about the climate change. It's about how the farmers should conform to the new norm.
Exactly.
And
it's them they don't want to make big changes. They're accustomed to the way things work or government subsidies or whatever.
Yeah.
But, you know, it'd be nice to change things up, make it a little bit better. So it's good for them and for everybody.
Yeah.
Like it doesn't have to be bad for them.
Yeah.
It just.
Yeah. But I think that's the problem, right? Because then the communication from the government or from this kind of new framework imposed on the farmer, or at least the farmers felt that way.
Yeah.
Then there was no perhaps meaningful dialogue between them. Not
who's doing it and how is it being handled?
There are a lot of mechanisms in between, but I think the bottom line is that the alternatives were not very clear or were not very possible.
It's
just always kind of the same problem, I think. So here also, Brazil also, you know, everywhere.
Mozambique. It's like,
I mean, okay, you have to change the way you do things. That's the law. But then if people don't have the clear alternative that is equally attractive to what they've been doing, I mean, they are not going to happily accept the new law.
This is where resistance comes from.
Yeah, exactly. So that's where I want to intervene, or my students, I want my students to think about how to think differently. You know?
I do. Are we done?
I think so. No, I don't know.
I think so. Thanks for coming down to my crazy basement.
No, it's been fun. It's actually very nice.
It's because,
yeah, it's kind of comfortable. I can keep on talking.
That was Kay. She's doing good work, bringing about incremental change, or at least understanding. I really liked hearing about her field work and also about the balanced approach required for what she does. There's no, this is objectively wrong, and there's no calling people evil and stuff like that. I've been guilty of calling a few people evil in my day, but I don't really believe it most of the time. Maybe I should go back to school and become one of Kay's students. You and I both know that I'm not going to do that. First of all, I don't want to go to Utrecht every day. But if I did, it sounds like the skills and concepts that she's teaching could be applied to a wide range of situations. Thanks for being on the show, Kay. We'll talk soon. And thank you for listening to Feel Free to Deviate. I really appreciate your time, and I hope you like what you're hearing. Does anybody actually listen to the end-of-show wrap-up? Well, I hope you do, because I'm taking the time to record it, but also because this is where you get to hear about my social links and stuff like that. Go to feelfreetodeviate.com for all the things that websites have, and follow me on Instagram at feelfreetodeviate. There are lots of lovely and fun promotional clips for you to like and share and comment on. Go for it. You're going to love it. Special thanks to Ed Mubarak. If you need audio wizardry, go to boomkaas.com. That's boomkaas.com. Ask for Ed and he will hook you up. I'm not sure who is up next. The next episode may be a surprise deviation from the standard format, or it may be an interview. Wait and see. You'll be slightly more surprised than I will be. Thanks again for listening, and I will be back in 2 weeks. Keep going. Do not quit. If you need to cry, that's okay. But don't let the bastards keep you down. Goodbye.